Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
So, Maria, it's a beautiful sunny day here in Kharkiv. It's very different from when we first met.
Right. Yeah.
That was over 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. The city was freezing cold. It was winter and it was under siege then.
I've come to meet Maria Avdiva, a security analyst and lifelong resident of the northeastern city of Kharkiv. She loves Ukraine's second largest city, so much in fact that at the beginning of the war in March 2022, after taking her children to safety, she returned to Kharkiv while it was being heavily shelled. She's fearless and wanted the world to see what was happening to her city. She's been something of a guide ever since I first got here.
Where are we going now?
We are going now to the best place in Kharkiv where people eat ice cream. It's in the Central Park in Kharkiv, and it's very very strange to see, even during the air raid alerts or like something happening around the city, people still come and bring their children and have some normal time.
You're listening to the documentary from the BBC World Service. I'm Quentin Somerville, this week on assignment in Ukraine. Kharkiv has been under constant attack since the war's start. It's only 30 kilometres from the Russian border. Russian troops made it inside the city at the beginning and were driven out. In May this year, they tried again and were forced back. At the heart of this elegant city, just by the university, is Shevchenko City Park. It's an oasis. Even in Kharkiv's darkest hours, its flower beds and lawns have been properly maintained. On a hot summer's day, Maria and I took a walk through the park to consider the challenges facing Ukraine after 2.5 years of war.
One of the things that's interesting on the front lines is, I haven't been in Ukraine for a year, but the previous year and a half, we were able to go to the first line and into zero line. It was very dangerous. But now we can't get there because it's extremely dangerous now. This war keeps developing new, horrible, sophisticated technologies which make it much more deadly. And I think that's one of the interesting things about this war, that there's an arms race, a technology race happening in the midst of this war on the front lines.
Yes, it has changed completely. I mean, how it's happening, because now with the developments of drone usage and also the technologies, it's you basically can see everything what's happening in real time. And you're completely right to say this is like a race of technologies, because when one country does one step, the other tries to like overcome it or think what will be the next move. But the use of artificial intelligence and all kind of technologies on the battlefields is just striking. And in this war, I've heard that soldiers say that it's like the strategies NATO was planning for Ukrainians to use, they don't work anymore. So you cannot like send the column of tanks to attack, because you have to be much more elaborate, because these tanks will be immediately seen and destroyed before they come.
As we're walking past through this beautiful park, one of my favorite parks in the city, a bride and groom.
Yeah, for them it's also an original. They usually come to the central square where they will take pictures of having the destroyed buildings at their back, like showing that we don't care what Putin wants, we continue with our lives.
I think we're getting close to the ice cream store.
Yes.
What are you going to have?
Ice cream, of course. Ice cream.
Which flavor?
Well, it's the best place, as I said, for ice cream, and they have a special ice cream which is called Belochka, the squirrel, and that's what everyone has here.
Okay, right, squirrel ice cream it is.
You don't have to drive for long from the peace of Shevchenko Park, perhaps just 30 minutes, to find the war. Russia has been making gains in the east and in the Kharkiv region too. Ukraine has a shortage of weapons and a shortage of manpower that is costing it territory. When I was there, President Zelensky was in Washington at a meeting of NATO. His eyes fixed firmly on November and a possible second Trump presidency, he tried to lock in support for Ukraine.
We are counting on strong decisions. Air defence, F-16s.
He urged NATO leaders to act, not to wait for November or any other month. Back in Ukraine, I join a drone team from the National Guard's 13th Hartier Brigade and head to the front lines outside the city.
The little black box on the front dash is called Sugar. It's a Ukrainian-made drone detector. Oh, it's gone off again. It only costs $100, but these men rely on it for their lives. It looks like it has multiple signals. Yevgeny, what's happening with the drone detector?
The drone detector has got Zala and Lancet Russian drones.
Is that why we're driving fast?
Yes, as we understand it, the Lancet is a very dangerous thing, but it works in tandem with the Zala, and it's hard for them to catch us at speed.
It's dusk, and Yevgeny, an infantry commander, is taking us to a trench position. We are crammed into the back of an unarmoured military pickup, which has drone jamming equipment on its roof. The jammer, though, can't counter all Russian drones, including those that are following us. The drone, unseen from above, follows the route we are taking, so the men head for an infantry trench, which offers better cover. Both sides in this war are using FPV, first-person view drones, which operators fly manually. They're small, cheap, and deadly. The men are squirreled away in this tiny little wooded copse. It doesn't give a lot of protection, but because it's summer, the growth is pretty thick and it's enough to hide them from drones. So when we were dropped off, the car dropped us off very quickly and sped away. They're really pretty careful here about not revealing their positions to the Russians, because it wouldn't take much for one of these FPV drones to make its way directly onto this position with lethal accuracy. And then we hear it.
So that drone we heard has passed overhead. So we need to get out of here fast.
In the shattered village of Lipsy, just 10 kilometres from the Russian border, I meet one of the 13th Hartier Brigade's drone attack teams.
So let's divide into groups by three people each.
They work from under the ruins of the village's destroyed buildings and operate close to Russian positions, in range of mortars, so spend as little time as possible in the open.
Almost there.
OK, almost there, said Petro.
So welcome to our castle.
Well, there are drones everywhere here, on every surface, cardboard boxes full of them. They've all been modified. I mean, the reason there are so many is because a lot of these are single-use kamikaze drones. They're flown by the pilots towards a target, usually Russian infantry. Sometimes they fly in buildings and through windows and detonate when they see that target. It's remarkable. At the beginning of this war, you'd see the occasional drone, but now there are these drone factories, really, which are just producing these munitions at an incredible rate.
It's the new way or a new path in modern war.
The 37-year-old commander of the unit goes by the call sign Aeneas. He was a property developer before the conflict.
In 2022, it was only infantry war. And today... One half, it's only drones war. And it drones battle between Russian drones and our drones.
The team launches a drone with a 2-kilogram bomb attached.
But we should go to the safe place. Go, 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 go. Go, 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 go.
Okay, so the drone operator now has goggles on. He's flying with his headset. We can see what he sees on a larger screen.
You can see the Russian flounder.
So Anis is just explaining that we're watching a live feed from a drone at the moment, and they've spotted a Russian soldier. He's hiding around some buildings in a field. I mean, it's really fascinating because it's quite clinical, but it's like watching a video game from this perspective. But if the drone is hunting you, it must be absolutely terrifying, though the reality is that for many of the soldiers who are killed in this way, they're unaware that they're being hunted.
When drone hit into Russian soldiers, it divided.
They show me an earlier kill where a drone finds a Russian soldier in the open. He runs for cover in a drainage ditch. The FPV drone operator finds him there, checking one end, then the other of the culvert, before detonating inside. It's a terrifying watch. It's their precision that makes them so effective, says Ineas.
Every day, about 100 enemy infantrymen died because of these drones. Only in our front line, because of drones, not because of artillery.
That's an enormous number.
But we have 100 kilometers of front line, so you can imagine how many enemies died every day.
One of the things about the drones is, these FPV drones, as they're called, is they're very difficult to escape if you're caught in the open.
And of course, Russian troops have the same weapons. They've been used to terrifying effect in Lipsy. The village is all but abandoned. In a shelter for displaced people in Kharkiv, after blackout, 57-year-old Svetlana explains how swarms of drones drove her and her neighbours from their homes there.
First, we would watch the drone. If it was flying low, then it was ours. But if the drone was flying high, it was Russian. Then we hid completely, so no one could see us. We hid under the trees, or wherever we could. And our soldiers would hide too. As soon as there was a Russian drone, no one was in sight. It's terrible. It's scary.
The Harty A Brigade is commanded by Colonel Ihor Oblensky. I've known him for a couple of years now and have watched as the men he commanded grew from a small volunteer unit to a full professional brigade that is now part of the Ukrainian Armed Forces National Guard. His underground command centre buzzes quietly with serious work. In various rooms, banks of screens with live pictures from drones stream images from the battlefield. The air smells of coffee, and the atmosphere is a mix of military discipline and internet startup.
Who has the superiority in the drone war? Is it Ukraine or is it Russia?
Well, at the moment, we have, you know, a kind of parity, because they produce more, they manufacture more, we produce less, but we're more flexible in application. The disadvantage is that they use more drones and more ammunition. Our advantage is that we respond faster to changes in the battlefield, which allows us to be more effective than they are.
Russia, too, is innovating by adding guidance systems to dumb bombs, some as large as 3,000 kilograms, which it launches from aircraft far from the front line where they glide to their targets. These glide bombs have a devastating effect on Ukrainian infantry trench positions, an advantage Ukraine is attempting to counter, says Ihor.
At the moment, we are grateful once again to Western partners who are helping us in this area. There are certain systems that are starting to affect enemy aircraft, forcing them to drop their bombs much further from our border. Plus, electronic warfare units are disrupting their GPS, making their bombs less accurate than they were initially. But it also forces us, infantrymen, to change our combat tactics.
You're listening to The Documentary from the BBC World Service.
You've heard of Charlie Chaplin, right? Well, Charlie Chaplin was my grandfather, and there was a time when he was the biggest star in all the world. But something happened, not just to him, but to hundreds of artists in Hollywood. They were forced to leave, forced out.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Assignment with me, Quentin Somerville.
Detection. Multiple drones. Multiple pilots. High signal strength.
So it's day two with the drone team. We're heading in a different direction to a different base. And it's a different setup that we're going to see there. These are their attack drones, heavyweight drones, which carry bombs up to 12 kilograms, looking for Russian command centres and Russian infantry positions.
Felt that. The window shook.
This unit is very close to Russian positions. Russian bombs, glide bombs, land about a kilometre away. The shockwaves shake the building. I feel the pressure wave in my chest and my back teeth. And I imagine what it must be like for the brigade's infantrymen out there at the front. Still, the drone team I'm with keep working above ground, preparing for a launch, as Aeneas looks on.
10 kilograms bomb. Russian calls it boogeyman drone.
I'm just watching on the screen as a live feed of one of their armed drones is just taken off. It's flying over green fields at the moment.
He said that there is problems with the signal.
The screen keeps going blue.
The drone was killed by a jamming system, this drone.
The Russian jamming system?
Russian jamming system.
Shortly after we left the drone team, I get a message. Two of the men we were with were hit in a Russian mortar attack, leaving one in a coma. Eventually, he would recover. But I wondered, how long can Ukraine sustain itself through this war when it's losing so many people to injury and death? It has lost experienced soldiers, and those left fighting are exhausted. Some women do serve in the army, but only men are conscripted. Conscription now starts 2 years earlier, at 25 until 60 years of age. I saw military draft officers detain and question young men on the streets of the capital, Kyiv. Back in Shevchenko Park, I noticed that in the evenings, when I would go for a run, how few men there were. On park benches, young women sat alone. Life is on hold, yet it must continue. The manpower shortage has become critical, something I discussed with security analyst Maria Avdiva.
Ukraine had a lot of volunteers in the first days of the war, but after 2 years, many were killed and wounded. And Ukraine now is struggling to bring more people to the army. And one of the strategies is to explain people who are naturally afraid to be killed. So they explain that army needs a lot of people on other positions, not only to go and storm the Russian trenches. So you can be a drone operator, you can do logistics. There are many parts in the army that you can help with.
I've asked this question to soldiers at the front for the past week, whether people should be allowed to object and say, no, I am not going to serve, it's not for me. They take a very dim view of that. Every single person I've spoken to said, no, this is an existential moment for Ukraine, you have to serve. What's your view on that?
It has to be like that. There has to be a clear rule that will be accepted by everyone in the country, that either we all join the war effort and do what is necessary, or then the country will be crushed.
And you have two young sons. Would you be happy for them to serve?
Well, I, of course, as a mother, it's a very difficult question. But then I think when it is a rule that you have to go and serve, then you're not thinking. You just obey the rule, because this is what everyone does. Your like neighbor next to you, your colleague, so everyone goes and does the same. And when you see that it's a united effort, then it makes such decisions easier.
Лёшка! Назад, нога! Сейчас пусть Лёшка встанет, вернётся назад. Проблема!
In this war, like most, foreign fighters are a feature. Initially, Ukrainians were mostly exclusively in a special international brigade. But now, as the manpower crisis bites, brigades, the Hartie included, are recruiting foreigners to fight alongside them. I'm at a wooded training ground just outside the city of Kharkiv, where some new recruits are being put through their paces. They're running through the trees, pretending to fire, under instruction from Ukrainian instructors. But the interesting thing about these recruits is none of them are Ukrainian. In fact, eight of them are from Colombia, one is from Sweden, and there's another who isn't saying where he's from. There just aren't enough raw recruits coming through from the Ukrainian ranks. Hello again.
Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Good.
Benice is Colombian. He came to Ukraine 3 months ago.
Vengo a ayudarle a las personas.
I've come to help people, simply to help. I didn't come here for the money. The Russians always have no respect for other people. We've been through 60 years of war in Colombia, and I also feel that many times we did not defend our territory. So now we are here.
Is that why there are so many Colombians here?
Bueno, yo tengo que ser...
Well, apart from that, I have to be honest. Unlike me, the reason a lot of young Colombians are here is for money.
The shortage of soldiers has brought about another new source of recruitment, one that Ukraine once rejected. In May, the country's parliament approved legislation that allowed certain prisoners to sign up and fight. But there are some restrictions. They must have only 3 years left of their sentence. They can't have committed sexual offences. Mass murderers also won't qualify for military duty. Their service will last as long as the war. Russia was heavily criticised, especially by Ukraine, when it sent convicts to the front.
Security.
This is a Soviet-era prison. It's the only high-security prison in the west of Ukraine. Guard dogs, lots of barbed wire. They have 28 men who've requested to be released to go and serve at the front, who'll be mobilised. This is the second tranche from this prison. The first 36 went to the front. Hi, Quentin, BBC.
My name is Vadim.
Hi, Vadim. Vadim Yamoshchuk is deputy head of the Department of Social, Educational and Psychological Work here at Correctional Colony Number 96.
Many convicts were waiting for this law. For years, they wrote various appeals for this to be a legislative initiative. Therefore, for many of them, this is like achieving their goal. Our institution has already been visited by representatives from 20 brigades, including the Marine Corps. The convicts can choose from that spectrum according to their potential.
Vadim leads us inside. The prison was once a factory. I'm led along corridors which smell of fresh bleach and invited into an interview room. Would I like to speak to the prisoners in private? Vadim politely asks. I do, and the first prisoner is brought in.
I am serving a sentence for car theft.
Maxim is 39 years old. He has 10 months of his sentence left to serve.
I'd rather go and defend my country, stand up for my land, than continue serving my sentence here. Russia took my home, my property, my business. Everything I had in Crimea, in Donetsk, was taken from me. We are all eager to fight, because many here have not achieved much in their lives. Now they have the opportunity to prove themselves as individuals, because if not us, then who?
Are you worried about the risks? You could be injured, you could lose a limb, you might die.
What is there to be afraid of? You understand, if it's meant for me to die, I'll die here or there if that's my fate. So I would rather, while I'm alive, bring some benefit to my community.
Yuri was arrested in Russia on drugs charges in 2016. He was sentenced to 10 years and extradited to Ukraine after serving 4. He has a year and a half left of his sentence. Will this make you
feel more worthy if you serve your country?
First and foremost, I will feel like a human being. If you ask whether I will fight for Ukraine or the land, it's more for the land and the people than for the flag itself. I've been in the penitentiary system for approximately 24 years out of my 40. What has the flag given me? Besides taking away a lot of time and its name, nothing. But I was born here, and I believe that we need to defend our land. I just want to do something grander and more useful in life than spending my whole life in prisons.
A world away from the prison, in the park in Kharkiv, I asked Maria Avdiva how she feels about prisoners being used as soldiers.
Well, from what I see, how it's the process is being made, they have a choice, so it's not obligatory. And so I think this is not a bad thing, because this allows them to fulfill their mission and help their country. When you face the grim possibility of the Russian advance, then, you know, you try to do everything what is possible.
Where does this end for Ukraine? I've noticed that the language coming from the Ukrainian government, which was always very firmly, we want our borders back to 1991, that language has softened. We're not hearing that as much now.
Well, I think that now the government knows that it's better not to create these overestimated expectations, and it's better to go step by step.
So there's a 2.5 years into the war, there's a deepening sense of realism.
Yeah, I think that as problems mount on people in Ukraine, it's better not to create more, but make communication honest and open.
You still believe Ukraine can win?
Yes, I do believe it, because otherwise there is no point of continuous fighting.
When I first met Colonel Ihor Obolensky in Kharkiv 2 years ago, I asked him how long he thought the war would last. Looking at the experience in Donbass, where Russian-backed insurgents began fighting Ukraine in 2014, he said then at least a decade. In his Hartie command centre, he now thinks the war will last even longer.
This war will be long. This war will last for decades, because there will never be peace with this nation that surrounds us. This neighbour is the enemy of our nation, who wants to destroy us. So we're likely to follow a more Israeli model. We will be a more militarised state. And believe me, this war will remind Russians for a very long time that they are incapable, that their system doesn't work, that their rotten government will soon collapse. Whether it's in 10 years or 20 years, it will happen.
On Ukraine's battlefields, the rules of war are being rewritten. It's the first conflict to use drones on this scale, and it's a glimpse into a bleak future where all wars might be fought like this. And both Russia and Ukraine are rewriting who is eligible to fight in those wars. Ukraine's shortage of manpower means it has expanded conscription and is recruiting those it had previously rejected. And the world wants to know when this war will end, how it will end, if it will end. Of course, it's a question for Ukrainians too, whose entire lives and society has been transformed by the conflict. But for them, it's almost incidental. They'll fight for as long as it takes, for as long as they can, because for now, as things stand, there is no alternative if Ukraine is to continue to exist. Thank you for listening to this episode of Assignment from the BBC World Service. I'm Quentin Somerville, and my producers were Lyndall Markwell, Tanya Dokson, and Lubov Shaludko.
You've heard of Charlie Chaplin, right? Well, Charlie Chaplin was my grandfather, and there was a time when he was the biggest star in all the world. But something happened, not just to him, but to hundreds of artists in Hollywood. They were forced to leave, forced out.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.